It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And this is one of those days when we had a very nice opening segment planned on what seemed like the most important news story of the day, and boom, something comes along at the last minute and upstages it. You probably, many of you, were hearing it discussed just now on the BBC. Never fear, we can do both. The new thing is that Trump's cabinet continues to disintegrate with the breaking news that he has fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And it actually relates in a way to the thing we were going to lead with. Anyway, new revelations about Russia's role in the 2016 election in a new book by the investigative reporters Michael Isikoff and David Korn. They are here in our studio and ready to go. Maybe the book release, which everyone knew was coming today, is even one reason for the timing of the House Intelligence Committee Republicans report released yesterday that concludes there was no collusion between Russia and Trump world, and even that Russia wasn't meddling in the election to help Trump. But in the book, Trump advisor Roger Stone reportedly boasts of having direct contact with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange during 2016. Of course, it was WikiLeaks, likely in collusion with Russia, that released the Democratic emails intended to hurt Hillary Clinton. We will somehow digest all of this now with Mother Jones Washington Bureau Chief David Korn and Yahoo News investigative reporter Michael Isikoff. Their book is called Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. Michael and David, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Good to be here.
Especially this morning.
So bored already. Nothing ever to get interested in. David, you tweeted this morning, Tillerson says Russia clearly involved in poisoning a former Russian spy in UK. Trump fires Tillerson. Hashtag just saying. What are you just saying?
Well, I found it, as have other people, somewhat odd that the day that Donald Trump chooses to fire Rex Tillerson, without any warning, apparently now we know that Tillerson learned about this from seeing Donald Trump's tweet, that this is the same time when Tillerson is saying Russia was clearly involved in this tragic case in the UK of apparently Russia poisoning an ex-Russian intelligence officer who was living there, who'd been gotten there through a spy swap. We know that yesterday the White House, said it was terrible what was happening with this case in the UK, but would not attribute it to Russia. So there, clearly they knew they were not attributing it to Russia in their public statements, even though Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, had already done so. And here comes Tillerson saying something different than the White House on this very fraught issue of Russia. And boom, he's bounced. I don't like to think of myself as a conspiracy theorist, right, but I know how conspiracy theorists do think, and I don't see how they avoid this. In fact, even in the book, we had a little bit of a scoop about Tillerson and his choice. Why don't you tell them about that, Mike?
Yeah, sure. There was an unpublished memo that was part of the Steele dossier that didn't get released, and it dealt with the period after the election when Donald Trump was interviewing candidates to be Secretary of State. One of them was Mitt Romney. Now, we go into the book because there's a lot of historical perspective, which I think we presented, and you go back to the 2012 election, and you remember Romney was the guy who called Russia the number one geopolitical threat to the United States, a comment that the Obama people mocked, saying this guy is stuck in the Cold War. He's clearly doesn't understand what's going on in the world today. Obama used that to his effect during one of the debates in 2012. So Romney had a track record with the Kremlin, and when his name gets floated, as a possible Secretary of State, there is a there's talk within the Russian government about their need to get to make sure that doesn't happen. Christopher Steele reported that. We quote from that unpublished memo by Christopher Steele in our book. And then, of course, shortly thereafter, Romney Fades and Rex Tillerson, who did have a very close relationship with Vladimir Putin. They had done business. He had done business deals at ExxonMobil in Russia.
He got a medal from Putin.
He got a medal from Putin. So,
people forget that on Saturday Night Live, very early in the Trump administration, there's this skit where Putin and Trump are meeting, and then Rex Tillerson, I think it was like a Christmas scene, and Rex Tillerson slides down the chimney, or maybe it's Putin who slides, but it's he and Rex who are, Rexy, Vladdy, and Trump feels left out.
Which makes it even more interesting that Tillerson took this line today about Russian involvement in this awful attack in the UK.
Yes. Now, CIA Director Mike Pompeo is the instant new nominee, but he's kind of a Russia hawk, too, as in this statement on Fox News Sunday just 2 days ago.
The Russians attempted to interfere in the United States elections in 2016. They also did so before that. There's a long history of Russian efforts to influence the United States and conduct influence operations against the United States. And it was Russians who actually engaged in this, not some buddy from outside of the country or disconnected from the Russia.
But when you say Russians, Russians with ties to the Kremlin, Russians with ties to Putin's regime?
Yes.
John Roberts with Mike Pompeo on Fox News Sunday. So before we get more explicitly into book content, Russia hawk going, Russia hawk coming, what's this really about for Trump?
Well, first of all, I don't really know that Pompeo, I'd necessarily put him in the Russia hawk camp, because I've heard Pompeo say things like that in the past. I was at the Aspen Security Forum last year where he gave a different formulation, but he was quite dismissive at that point. He said, Russia meddled in the 2016 election, just like they did in the election before that, just like they did in the election before that. Well, that's actually not true. That what the Russians did in 2016, the way they weaponized what they'd hacked from the DNC and the Podesta emails, the information warfare campaign, was materially different and a dramatic escalation from anything that had taken before. My take on Pompeo is that he has been he's extremely political, that he has aligned himself with the president, doesn't want to get out of step with the president. He had to say what he said in that interview with John Roberts, because that is the overwhelming consensus of the intelligence community. There are not even any real dissents from within the intelligence community to that conclusion. So he had to say at least that. But it remains to be seen whether he will be as tough on the Russians as many would like him to be.
So do you think, David, that anything is lost to the country by this switch of secretaries of state? You know, I remember when the Russia meddling story was first breaking after the election, around the same time that Tillerson was being named. And I thought, and probably said on the air, I'm much more concerned about the impact of ExxonMobil's CEO leading our foreign policy than I am about what Russia might have done in the United States. Maybe I was wrong, but this was arguably the biggest climate change polluter in the history of the world brought in to make foreign policy.
I don't think a shift in personnel at the top makes much of a difference in this administration. I think on some of the key issues, whether it's climate change, which is something I care about a lot, you know, Trump has staked out the wrong position or an inaccurate position, not based in science, and has unleashed people like that throughout the administration. I think our book shows that, as Mike was saying, the Russian attack on American democracy in 2016 was quite profound, and one thing that we tried to do was to, because the story has emerged in bits and pieces over the last year and a half. You and I have talked about it intermittently, and there are great scoops that have come out from all sorts of media organs. But it also tends to be sometimes convoluted, or things come and go so fast, you don't really see the big picture. So we tried to weave all this together into a cohesive, comprehensible, and I hope engaging narrative about what happened historically, what happened during the campaign, how the Trump campaign responded, how the Obama administration responded, while advancing the story where we could. And I think it shows, though, at the end of the day, we're left, America, we had a crisis This was a real crisis. And I don't think it was fully addressed by President Obama at the time. And it's certainly with Donald Trump. He has run away from it. He's tried to deny it's happened. And so whether Pompeo, as Secretary of State or CIA Director or anybody else, can do what needs to be done to prevent this from happening in the future remains at question if Trump himself still won't come to terms with this.
Got it. My guests are, if you're just joining us, Michael Isikoff and David Korn, whose new book together is Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. So one of the pieces of news from the book is about Trump campaign advisor, I guess it's George Papadopoulos, right? Mm-hmm. Saying Trump encouraged him to have contact with the Kremlin during the campaign.
Right. This is the first clue of what Papadopoulos has told Mueller's investigators since he pled guilty last fall and became a cooperating witness. And it contradicts what has been the public accounts of a very critical March 31, 2016 meeting that Trump has with his foreign policy advisory team. This is the first time he's just announced the foreign policy advisory team. This is the first meeting. Papadopoulos comes in from London, says he's had these contacts in the UK with people with ties to the Kremlin who want to set up a meeting between him, Trump, and Vladimir Putin. The previous accounts have been that this suggestion was quickly dismissed, that Jeff Sessions said, we're not going to talk about that anymore, and that was the end of the discussion. What Papadopoulos has said, we report in this book, is very different. He said Trump encouraged him, said he found the idea interesting, looked at Sessions, expecting him to follow up, and Sessions nodded. Now, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this nugget from our book is something we learned last night, actually, which is when the House Intelligence Committee wrapped up its investigation, finding no collusion, nothing to see here, they never talked to Papadopoulos. They knew nothing about what's in our book, about what Papadopoulos was telling investigators. So I think that does raise some questions. And there are other examples that we can discuss.
Well, let's go on to another example. Yeah. So Papadopoulos is one, and that newly revealed by you thing that he said. You also write about Roger Stone and what you call his alibi in the book, falling apart. Tell us about Roger Stone and WikiLeaks.
Well, Roger Stone in the summer of 2016, August, September. Well, first let me say, you know, he was an intimate and advisor of Donald Trump for years, if not decades. And he worked on the campaign initially, then left the campaign, but still remained a Trump supporter. And in the summer of 2016, he is saying publicly and talking publicly that he has a direct contact with Julian Assange. And this is after WikiLeaks has joined the Russian operation to attack the Hillary Clinton campaign by releasing hacked DNC emails at the Democratic Party convention in mid-July. And the interesting thing is that the Clinton campaign is watching Stone very carefully. You know, the way that you would watch, like, Tremors as a seismologist. Mm. They're looking at his tweets, and looking at his public statements, and they're going, you know, what does this mean? Does this mean that the Trump camp, in some ways, is actually colluding and connected to what's going on in terms of this Russian operation? So Stone then puts out tweets in end of August and September and October that seem to suggest he has advanced knowledge of what WikiLeaks is doing. You know, particularly in the beginning of October, wait to the next WikiLeaks attack. This is going to be the big one. He essentially says, and that was shortly before the John Podesta emails are put out by WikiLeaks. So this has raised the question whether he was a go-between, whether he had anything to do with this operation. After the election, more or less, he has said, well, I didn't really have direct communications with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. I gleaned what I could from reading Assange's tweets very closely. Plus, I had a back-channel communication through a fellow named Randy Credico, who is a radio host in New York City, a comic on the left, a Bernie Sanders supporter, who was a fan of Julian Assange. So this is like, so I didn't directly talk to Assange. I went through this guy named Randy, who I'm friends with. Well, that's how Randy Credico said. He, in an interview for the book, he says, you know, I didn't talk to Julian Assange ever until the end of August, and he never told me what he was doing. And I didn't tell this to Roger Stone because I didn't know. I had nothing to share. So it seems like his cover story, according to Credico, is not credible. Stone has told us that Credico isn't remembering this correctly. But it seems to suggest that either he was outright just lying at the time, or there's something else to the story here. I don't know if Mike has anything to add.
Yeah, no, but can I just give you one other quick example
that's
not in this House Intelligence Committee report?
Mm-hmm.
You've all heard about the notorious Trump Tower meeting in June of 2016 when these Russians come to meet with Donald Trump
offering
Jr.
dirt on Hillary offering Clinton, dirt on Don Clinton. Jr. and Jared Kushner,
yeah,
and Paul Manafort.
Yeah. The people who set that up were Rob Goldstone, the British publicist for Emin Agalarov, the son of the Russian oligarch Aras Agalarov, and an aspiring pop singer. There was a...
Well, explain what their connection to Trump was.
Well, these are the people who were with Trump in Moscow in 2013 for the Miss Universe pageant. Agalarov and Trump had an agreement to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. There was a business deal that Trump was very focused on, which fell apart. We can talk about why it fell apart. But my point was, there was a first Trump Tower meeting that you haven't heard about before.
When?
In which, in January of 2015, when Goldstone and Emin Agalarov go to Trump Tower, are welcomed by Trump himself.
2015.
And Trump gives strong indications about his plans to run for president. I can tell you, I know for a fact, that the House Intelligence Committee knew nothing about this first Trump Tower meeting. So here they've spent over a year investigating all these connections that Trump has, you know, had with Russians and what it added up to, and they didn't know something that's reported for the first time in our book out today.
And Steve Bannon had said to Michael Wolff for his book that he was pretty sure that Donald Trump Sr. would have been told by Donald Trump Jr. In fact, that Trump Jr. would have walked those Russians up, probably upstairs in Trump Tower, and
meet the candidate.
So you have an additional piece of evidence here about a relationship between those Russians at the meeting
and Trump
Donald
himself.
Trump going back a year and a half earlier.
Yeah, and it's important because Trump brought Miss Universe to Moscow in 2013, only because he partnered up with Aras Agalarov, the father of Emin, who was a big oligarch. He was called Putin's builder. And we know that for 30 years, Trump had wanted to develop a tower in Moscow. And he saw Miss Universe as really the stepping stone. And he was in bed with an oligarch who was close to Putin. He also knew that to do anything like that in Russia, you had to have Putin's approval. You couldn't certainly tick him off. So throughout Miss Universe and in the years afterwards, in 2014, 2015, you know, Trump makes a series of comments that are very positive about Putin. And people have wondered about that all this time. But a very simple explanation is that he knew that if he said anything critical about Putin, that would squelch any business opportunities he had. So he had this ongoing relationship with the Agalarovs. He had an ongoing desire to build. And so the Agalarovs come to him in June and say, the Russian government wants to help you. So of course this meeting moves forward and the deals keep moving forward as well.
Michael Isikoff and David Korn with us. Their new book, Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. We can take a few questions for them on the research for their book. Let's hold Tillerson things and other things for later. There are so many pieces of wool in this book through which they're trying to weave a sweater of collusion. Let's go into some of these details. If you have questions for them, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War in America and the Election of Donald Trump. So let's take a step back from where we've just been in the last 10 minutes. You have George Papadopoulos green-lighted to go make contact with the Kremlin during the election campaign. That's new. You have this contact between Trump and the Agalarovs. a year and a half before the Trump Tower meeting. What was the third one we talked about?
Roger Stone and Randy Credico. Yeah.
Roger Stone right. having direct...
His public account now being contradicted right. by his alibi witness.
With WikiLeaks, which right. released the damaging emails. How close are you to a sweater? Because what we don't have, I think, through your account or through Michael Adam Schiff's account on the House Intelligence Committee, the Democratic side, or anyone quite yet, is that all these pieces add up to Donald Trump saying, "Okay, Russia." Although he said it,
he did say it, Brian.
Out loud.
But Brian, the thing, so much of this has been hiding in plain sight,
right?
And when we talk about the particulars, people say collusion, and Donald Trump says no collusion. Well, it depends kind of what you mean by collusion. Is there evidence that Donald Trump sat down with Russian agents and told them what emails to hack and when to release them? Probably not so, and probably doesn't exist. But is there a situation, this is why we put everything together and create a narrative, because you can see that time and time again, Donald Trump and people around him are cooperating with Russians, are talking to Russians, are signaling to the Russians that they don't mind this operation. Donald Trump keeps denying it
right.
through the election and afterwards in a way that we end up characterizing as essentially aiding and abetting.
Right.
I mean, even on August 17th, he's given his first intelligence briefing August 17th, 2016, as the GOP nominee. And he's told by the U.S. intelligence community, Russia is doing this. This is what our intelligence says, and there's not much of a question. James Clapper in our book confirms this, I think, for the first time. And even after that, he keeps going out and saying, "Oh, who knows if it's the Russians? It's probably not the Russians. Right. Russia.
Right.
That helps Russia get away with this if he's throwing up, dust and making the picture cloudy.
And not only is he acting like he's got something to hide, and all these people in Trump world keep acting like they have something to hide because they keep covering up the contacts that they had at that time with Russia, and some of them have now been charged by Mueller for lying about specifically that. Trump goes for all these advisors during the campaign who were so Russia connected. Flynn had been honored at that event for the Russian propaganda news outlet RT. No. Manafort had all those Russia ties. Papadopoulos had the Kremlin connections. Carter Page was already being investigated as a possible Russian spy since 2013.
Right. Yeah. One of the quotes in our book, Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland, Secretary of State for European Affairs, when she learns that Manafort has joined the Trump campaign, her reaction is, "Manafort, he's been a Russian stooge for 15 years. She was well aware of his work for many, many years for the pro-Russia political party in Ukraine and their leader, Yanukovych, who now resides in Moscow, who fled to Moscow. So, yeah, there are a lot of these threads that, when you put it all together, you're kind of like astonished, like how did all this happen and why and what does it all add up to? I got to say, David and I both separately for our news organizations covered this during the 2016 campaign. I was the first to report that there was U.S. intelligence investigation of somebody associated with the Trump campaign. That was Carter Page. David was the first to report about the existence of Christopher Steele's work and his memos. But if you would have told me at the time of the 2016 election when Trump won, that a year and a half later, this would still be the dominant issue that would be hanging over Trump's presidency, I would have been astonished. I never would have thought it would have the legs that it has. And to some degree, that's because not what happened during the campaign, but what happened after Trump became president, because one of the first things he does in the new administration, we report about this in the book, is push a plan to get rid of sanctions on Russia. seemingly confirming all the conspiracy theories people were floating during the campaign.
That could be the quo in the quid pro quo.
Right? The decision to fire Comey, we have some new insights into how that might have come about. That you remember, there's the famous moment in early January when Trump is getting the intelligence briefing about Russia's interference in the election, and then there's this really amazing orchestrated episode where all the intelligence community leaders, John Brennan, James Clapper, Michael Rogers, leave the room so James Comey can stay back and give Trump a two-page synopsis of that Christopher Steele dossier. Now, the reasoning was Trump had to know what was out there, that this was circulating in the media, it might come up. Trump's reaction is it's a shakedown. That's what he tells his aides. He believes he's being blackmailed.
By Russia?
By Comey. He believes Comey is blackmailing him, letting him know we got something on you.
Huh.
That's how it's processed in Trump's mind. And we talk about that sort of moment planted the seeds for Trump to get rid of, to fire Comey, which became the most disastrous decision of his presidency. It led directly to the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel.
I mean, it shows the depths of his paranoia because, and throughout the transition period, the presidency, he has yet to say publicly that he believes the Russian meddling was a priority and that future meddling is a threat that needs to be taken care of. So when he's given the briefing on what the intelligence community found about Russia and then is told about this, the dossier, and really, Comey's thinking, everyone else's thinking was, we got to tell him. He has to know what's out there. And all he can think about is, they're trying to get me. They're trying to set me up. They want me under their thumb, the intelligence community of the United States.
Because he sees everything through those kinds of lenses.
And we put it in the context of the way his old mentor, Roy Cohn, looked at the world. That's the kind of thing Roy Cohn would have done.
What Hoover would have done.
And that's the kind of thing J. Edgar Hoover would have done.
Yeah.
And that's actually in the introduction to our book.
I think Annette in Manhattan has a central question. Annette, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Given that governance in our country is now so intertwined with the marketplace, I'm wondering what your guests think of this. I've been told that the connection between the Trump people and Russia was that they've been laundering money for Russian oligarchs. Do they have a response to this?
You can find lots of rumors and theories and speculation about Trump's finances. He has done business with Russians in the past. His sons have each boasted individually of Russian money coming into their enterprises. Not illegally, of course, but legally. But at the same time, it's been very opaque. We don't have Trump's taxes. His Trump organization has hundreds of shell companies, and so that type of opaqueness does fuel speculation. He's had an unusual relationship with Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank was accused of Russian money laundering. So it's easy for people to connect these dots. I mean, the thing is, this is why we need good investigations in Congress and elsewhere to get to the bottom of some of these, some of this information, and for Trump to release his taxes so we have as open a view of his finances so that we don't have to have such speculation about the president of the United States.
Right. But people say there are three things that Mueller is looking at with respect to Trump. One is collusion, one is obstruction of justice, and the third is money laundering or other financial crimes having to do with Russia. And you look at this in the book.
We do look at it, but to be fair, it's not clear to me that Mueller has gone into Trump's finances. We know he's certainly gone into Manafort's finances, and I believe he subpoenaed records from Deutsche Bank related to Manafort. Going after Trump's finances directly, that I think Mueller knows would be a direct confrontation, that would be crossing a red line for Trump, and he's not going to do it without a clear predicate, with actual evidence that forms a basis for subpoenaing Trump's business records.
Boris in Flatbush, you're on WNYC with Michael Isikoff and David Korn. Hi, Boris.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. I have a question that's pretty far in the weeds, but I'm trying to connect a couple of dots.
We are already so far in the weeds.
We're weeds guys.
That we're going to need some Scott's lawn product to get us out. Go ahead.
It gets much deeper. Okay, so here's my question. So in June of 2016, before Cambridge Analytica started working for the Trump campaign, the president, Alexander Nix, reaches out to Julian Assange to ask him to share Clinton-related emails so the company could aid in disseminating them. 3 months later, Rebecca Mercer, who was also like on the board of directors of Cambridge Analytica, asks Alexander Nix whether the company could better organize the Clinton-related emails being released by WikiLeaks to make them more searchable. Then, Guccifer 2.0, the Russian hacker cutout, used social media to invite individual reporters to request specific caches of stolen DNC documents and handed them out the way political operatives distribute scoops to amplify the consequences of the cyber attack. My question to you is this. Do you see any indication that Cambridge Analytica made their searchable archive available to Guccifer 2.0 so the hacker group could more easily disseminate the material to the press and maximize its
I'm not sure they would have needed to. If Guccifer 2.0 was a Russian cutout, as the U.S. intelligence community believes, they didn't need Cambridge Analytica to help them organize the Russian the hacked emails. They already had them. It was the Russians who hacked the emails, and it was the Russians who set up, according to the U.S. intelligence community, Guccifer 2.0. So, and yes, you're absolutely right about the way Guccifer 2.0 distributed those emails selectively to political reporters around the country. This is a part of the Russian operation that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. It wasn't just about the presidential election. They were meddling in individual congressional races, swing districts, trying to tilt the balance in particular swing districts. And Guccifer 2.0 released emails that were damaging to particular candidates in Florida, in Pennsylvania, elsewhere, to political reporters in those districts.
Targeting Democrats.
Targeting Democrats. That arguably made as much of an impact, if not more, on the election than what they were doing nationally.
Also, the reason why this is particularly important, and we go into depth in the book about the attack on congressional races, is because we have congressional races coming up. We have the midterms in 2018, and we've already had, Mike Pompeo, was it Mike Rogers who said, the other day that they expect
Director of National Intelligence, well, Trump appointee.
Mike Rogers is the
head of the NSA.
NSA.
Yeah, he said just a few days ago that they expect Russia to try again in terms of meddling in the 2018 midterms, is that we can see how it worked in 2016. And in fact, in some ways, it's probably easier to influence a local congressional election than it is a big national election. And so the fact that the federal government under Trump is not taking, really extensive steps to prevent that is frightening.
We're almost out of time, but I want to get a little bit to the Obama stuff in this book. Specifically, what did Obama know and when did he know it about Russian interference? And did he fail, in your opinion, to take action that would have been warranted?
Well, we do go into quite a bit of depth on the Obama administration's handling of the matter. And we have a lot of new information, and particularly about plans, proposals that were being developed by White House staff members, Michael Daniel, who was the White House cybersecurity coordinator, for a aggressive pushback against the Russians to go after Russian news sites, to dismantle Guccifer 2.0 and other Russian hacking sites that had been set up. There was also proposals for information warfare by the U.S. against the Russians to dump information about Putin's corruption, bank accounts on behalf of his daughters in Latvia. They were all nixed by the Obama White House. In fact, Susan Rice, the National Security Director, tells Michael Daniel to stand down, knock it off. We don't want to box the president in. Now, they were in a bind. This was a very difficult moment.
They didn't want to look like they were being political in favor of Clinton.
And they also worried about cyber escalation. If they hit back in a cyber way, in fact, in one meeting, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said that perhaps Russians would hit back and take down our electric grid. Turns out the United States is far more dependent on our cyber infrastructure than Russia is. So it's really my favorite chapter in the book, chapter 14, because it does lay out these incredibly creative and sometimes very aggressive plans that people in the National Security Council came up with, and the dilemmas faced by Obama and the policymakers about whether to engage that way or fear that it could lead to something worse, and particularly in a way that might end up totally blowing up the election. Their guiding principle was, we got to make sure we don't do anything that would call into question the legitimacy of the election itself and blow the 200-year-old tradition of a peaceful transition of power. So, I mean, to me, this is the what would you do chapter. You read this chapter, you look at both sides, and you go, wow, what would I do? Would I take these plans? Would I be more concerned about this? And I'm quite proud that we got into both sides there. And I think critics of the Obama administration will latch onto it in certain ways, and other people might see it. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, the Russian operation did succeed. They got what they wanted. And the question is, what, if anything, could have been done to prevent that?
So, last question. Since the book is out today and a news editor or two has been known to listen to this program, if there was one question to ask Sarah Huckabee Sanders at the White House press briefing, if there's one this afternoon, because I don't think either of you guys are going to get access, based on the new material in the book, what might it be?
I would ask about the two matters that we discussed at the top of the show, about what Papadopoulos told then candidate, now President Trump. What does President Trump remember about that, if anything?
Yes.
His meetings with the Agalarovs and Goldstone and the first Trump Tower meeting. Tell us what the president recalls, if anything, about it. You wouldn't be highly confident we'd get much of an answer from Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but the questions should be asked.
But that's where you want the brackets, all right?
Right. Yeah, and there's one issue that we haven't talked about yet that I think is really a key thing that happened. When Trump was running for president in 2015, he had a secret deal to build a tower in Moscow. Think about this.
This is the second Trump Tower deal in Moscow.
So he's running for president. He says he's going to put America first, but on the side, he's negotiating, in essence, with Putin. And he's saying positive things about Putin in public. He has never addressed this publicly.
That's the money part I was trying to get at before.
Yeah, he was trying to make money while running for president. He was trying to make money by entering into a deal, in essence, with Putin. And he's never publicly been held to account for this, never has publicly explained it. I don't think Sarah Sanders would address this question. As she would say, I'll take that and come back to you. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it's something that he still should be pressed on.
Michael Isikoff, chief investigative reporter for Yahoo News, and David Korn, Washington Bureau chief for Mother Jones, authors now of Chapter 14 and the 20 other chapters in Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. Thank you both so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to talk to you.